Sexual assault as a general discussion topic never seems to be out of the news for long. This autumn, there's been a lot of talk about sexual assault on college campuses as society, victims, and offenders come to grips with how sex assault happens. We'll spend this first hour of today's exchange talking about the state of the art in sexual assault investigations and prosecution. Our guests both train investigators and will both be in Ashland for the Southern Oregon Sexual Assault Symposium later this week, and they came down early for additional sessions and join us here in the studio. They are Steve Belshaw, who's the Deputy Chief at the Salem, Oregon Police. Steve, welcome.
Thank you.
And we also have Jenna Harper, who is the Training Program Coordinator at the Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. Jenna, welcome to you.
Thanks.
Let's find out a little bit about each of you and your jobs. Yours, the police chief we know a little bit about, deputy chief we know a little bit about, but let's talk about your job, Jenna, and what that involves.
Sure. So the organization that I work for, we're a private nonprofit organization, and I run our training program. So we're very system-based, so we do trainings not only for law enforcement in investigating sexual assault, but we also train sexual assault nurse examiners. So those are the nurses who work with patients who are survivors, providing them with medical care and doing the sexual assault forensic exam, what people commonly refer to as the rape kit. We also train advocates whose primary job is to support sexual assault survivors. We just finished our week-long training last week. We do training with prosecutors of sexual assault and then sexual assault response teams as well.
So there are lots of people to train in lots of different aspects of the whole sexual assault investigation process.
Definitely. And the main theme throughout all of our trainings is this core concept of being victim-centered and always putting the victim first.
Steve, I'm going to guess you've been a police officer for a fair amount of time. So silver hair gives us both away.
25 years.
Uh-huh. And how much over that time has this kind of training changed and evolved? And how many different people does it affect now, more than it used to?
Well, it's changed drastically in the 25 years that I've been in law enforcement. And it is continuing to change over the last couple of years about how we're dealing with victims, what we're understanding about trauma and how trauma affects memory. And we're finding out that in law enforcement, we've kind of been getting it wrong for a while. And so what we're learning is we're having to change the way we do interviews and the way we approach victims and approach these cases.
Well, you're going at it too soon? Was that the issue before?
Part of it. Part of it is what we did is we asked victims to tell us things in a logical, linear fashion. What happened next? What happened next? Those kinds of things. And the studies that have come out in the last 2 or 3 years about how trauma affects your brain and affects memory is that's not how these events are recorded. And so we're learning that you have to let the victim tell you the events that happened as they can remember them, and that recollection is going to be a process. They may not be able to tell you all of that at the first interview. It may take a couple of interviews and a couple of times. And what's fascinating is some of this is based on our research on officers that have been involved in shootings. We learned long ago that that officers who are involved in a shooting, we typically don't interview them for at least 48 hours for them after the shooting to get some sleep, get the adrenaline out of their system, and get their thoughts together. And that gives us the most correct version, the most accurate version of the events that happened. And we never correlated that to victims of sexual assault, that they're going through a similar trauma and that we should give them time to collect their thoughts and give us a good, accurate version of the events of that.
Was the thinking, until you incorporated that more recent thinking, I mean, was it a rush to sort of interview the sexual assault victim within the first 12 to 24
hours?
Sure,
we were thinking there is – we need to identify who the suspect is, get them in custody if we can, gather the evidence, those kinds of things. But it's really no different than an officer-involved shooting or a homicide or those kinds of things. We've learned over the years on those events to slow down, take our time, process things very methodically, and now we're learning to apply those same principles to sexual assault investigations, and we're getting better interviews and more accurate accounts.
We're talking about sexual assault investigation with Steve Belshaw, who's the deputy chief at the Salem Police. Jenna Harper is training program coordinator at the Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 around the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We can also be found on Facebook, and you can see Steve and Jenna from just a few moments ago. One of the issues I find in having any discussion about sexual assault is trying to get a good fix on trends. And when I was looking yesterday at what you can get is FBI crime stats, and one particular set I noticed that kept coming up was 1994 to 2010, which indicated a general lessening of the number of incidents of sexual assault. And when I presented that to you two in the room, there was some serious skepticism right off the bat. Jenna, tell us about that.
So we know that sexual assault is the number one underreported crime in this nation. There are so many barriers to, number one, just accessing services, medical services, advocacy services, to disclosing to friends and family, and then to reporting to law enforcement. And the You Have Options program that we're here to do a training for earlier this week before the Sexual Assault Symposium is such a great program because it addresses those barriers for survivors first and foremost. So there's a huge stigma attached to sexual assault. It's a shameful, embarrassing crime in this nation right now. And so that first and foremost, but the fear of not being believed, fear of retribution, financial issues. There's so many concerns in coming forward and telling people that you've experienced this.
It seems really hard to believe we're still talking about it in these terms, 15 years almost into the 21st century.
Yes, you'd like to think that we made more progress in this. And I think it's great. Recently, we've been talking so much more around university sexual assault. We've got the White House behind us. It's great momentum. We hear talk of domestic violence through the NFL, them addressing it after, some mistakes. And so it's great that we're talking about it more. It needs to be talked about so that shame and that stigma is brought down. One in four women in the state of Oregon has experienced a rape in her lifetime. We're talking about so many people in our community and so many men, too. There's some unique barriers to men reporting. And so we know that men report at such a low rate, too.
So one in four women and about, 80% of sexual assaults are not reported is the estimate?
It's so hard to try and figure out the number of people who don't report. Mm-hmm. There's a great piece of research that came out from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. They put out what we call the NISPIS, which is the acronym for the National Intimate Partner Sexual Violence Survey in 2010. And that's, I think, the best piece of research we have. They didn't look at just cases reported to law enforcement. They did a phone survey. And I think that's the best piece of reliable information. And in the nation, it's one in five women. In the state of Oregon, it's one in four women who've experienced rape at some point in their lifetime.
And with that makes it, what was the number I saw? Something like there's something happening like every few seconds or so. Like every 20 seconds somebody experiences sexual assault in America, which is not a real fun thing to think about. Now, do the numbers potentially come up then? I mean, this is something we've talked about with several realms of crimes, including child abuse, child sexual abuse, et cetera. I don't mean to just throw it off with an et cetera, but the idea being that the more people are aware that there is a crime there, the more ultimately they will report it over time, Steve?
Yeah, you're going to see the numbers go up. And part of, again, why Jenna touched on this, the numbers go down, is if you come to law enforcement and you're not believed or you're not getting a good reception, that word spreads in the community and people give up. They quit reporting. So what we want to encourage, and especially with programs like this You Have Options program, is start by believing the victim of coming forward, because this is not an easy process to go through an interview and talk to some person in a uniform that you've never met before about some really embarrassing and intimate details. And so we want to encourage victims to come forward, that they'll be supported, that they'll be believed. And you heard about the training that Jenna talked about, all the training that they do of advocates and SANE nurses and prosecutors. It's not just a law enforcement response. It is a combined team response. And so getting all these folks on the same page so that victims feel supported, and that word will get out, and you will see see those numbers go up, and you should see that. That doesn't mean we're having more sexual assaults happen. It just means we're finally getting a true picture of what's going on in our communities.
Which must present some interesting challenges for the public relations end of police work when, in fact, if your figures begin to go up in a community, then you have to say, no, this is not because we're having a lot of stranger rapes. Mm-hmm. It's because we're just getting more people reporting things that happen to them.
Sure, and we're just starting to recognize those things. And one of the trends that we're trying to teach our officers in law enforcement as well is we have typically put sexual assault and domestic violence as two separate crimes. You have domestic violence units, you have sexual assault units. We all know that domestic violence is about power and control. And so what better way to take control of another person than to sexually assault them within marriage or within a relationship? And we don't ask about that. But when we talk to our shelters and we are asking our shelters about our domestic violence victims, they're telling us 75 to 80% of our domestic violence victims have disclosed to them that they've been sexually assaulted by a partner. And we're not asking about that. So when we start asking about those things, again, our numbers are going to go up. But we need to get a good idea of that, because our job is to hold people accountable in our community for bad behavior. Every community has standards that they have set, the laws and statutes, and they expect law enforcement to enforce those statutes. This is what behavior is acceptable in our community, and we're not going to accept the fact that you can sexually assault your wife or your girlfriend in a relationship, and we're going to hold you accountable for that.
I noticed the use of the term IPV. Both of you have used it already. Intimate partner violence. Is this a fairly recent coining of terms, or something that's been around for a few years?
I think oftentimes when we think of domestic violence, it's folks who live within a household. It includes family members. So intimate partner violence would include anyone who's in a romantic relationship. So, you know, first and foremost, we would think of marriage. But anyone, same-sex folks, people who are boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever that might look like, anyone who is in that intimate partner relationship and there's some sort of violence within it is what we would be referring to.
And that's what is collected in the NISVIS. Is that
NISVIS?
Yikes! Acronyms out the. Yeah. Okay. So, I did mention stranger rape a moment ago, and now we're talking about intimate partner violence. The ratio is very much in favor of the intimate partner. I mean, not in favor, but I mean, that's where most of the incidents happen. Is that right, Jenna?
Yes. The vast majority of people know their perpetrator, whether that's their intimate partner, whether it's someone in their family, someone that they work with, somewhere in their friend group, an acquaintance. You know, we've been taught by media that rape is a stranger rape, someone who comes out of the bushes in the alley with a weapon. It's a very violent attack. And that, for most people, is not what sexual assault is like.
We're talking to Jenna Harper, the training program coordinator of the Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force, and Steve Belshaw, the deputy chief at Salem Police, about sexual assault investigation and the state of the art. They're both in the region for the Southern Oregon Sexual Assault Symposium later on this week, and also finding out more about the You Have Options program at the Ashland Police Department. And we can talk about the history with Steve's department in Salem about that. You can join us with your questions, your comments, your information about sexual assault and thoughts about it. 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. When we talk about the intimate partner violence and the connection to domestic violence, I was struck by something that Carrie Hull from Ashland Police, the founder of the You Have Options program by that name, mentioned, because the question I was asking was about circumstances in which a person in a sexual relationship will say yes and then say no, and at that point it becomes a rape. But she pointed out there doesn't even have to be a no, and gave the circumstance of somebody who believes that if she does not have sex, or if he or he does not have sex with their partner, there will be a beating.
Sure. And we had a case like this. So we had one of our patrol officers did an absolutely fantastic job, where we had a victim that showed up for work, had a broken nose, and a coworker said, you know, what happened? She said, you know, I ran into a door and the coworker wasn't buying it. Talked to her at length and finally convinced her to call the police. So the officer responded and said, what happened? And she said, I came home. My husband and I argued. I said, I've had enough of this. I'm leaving. He said, you're not leaving. And I tried to get by him. He pushed me back. I pushed him, and he hauled off and hit me in the nose. Blood everywhere. And he said, I'm sorry. You know, I don't mean to do this. Help me clean up. And he said, again, I'm very sorry. Let me make this up to you. I love you more than anything. Let's have sex. And the officer said, well, what did you do? And she said, I had sex with him. And he said, did you want to? And she said, no, that's the last thing I wanted to do. And he said, what do you think would have happened if you said no? And she said, look at my face. It would have been worse. So there has to be consent in every sexual relationship. And there clearly, she did not have the ability to say no in that relationship. He'd already demonstrated that he would act violently if she didn't agree to what she was doing. And so that officer actually arrested the husband for rape as well as the assault. And we prosecuted that case because she clearly didn't want to do that. And no was not an option in that case for her.
Jenna, I imagine you attend a lot of trainings yourself across the country, including things like the Sexual Assault Symposium. Are there any states where there are still legal protections for husbands who rape wives?
So in 1993, I believe it was, North Carolina was the last state to eliminate the marital rape exemption. There actually are some very partial exemptions to it. For example, in Washington State, there's a small partial exemption for one of the statutes. So it very much is built into our culture, and it's not that long ago that it was eliminated. But the idea of consent is one that I don't think we talk about very often. I mean, we don't talk around it at our dinner table. We don't talk about it in school. And I think it is not the easiest thing to discuss. And Steve says something that's really great when we go around and talk to people. If fear is in the room, then consent is not. So it's really important to think about, what is this person fearful of? That if they don't comply with going through with this, well, are they afraid? Is there a threat that their children will be taken away? Are they afraid that they're going to be fired because the person in the room is their employer and they're holding this over them? And so it's a very complex concept that we need to be talking about more with people starting in, I think, high school, starting to talk about what is a healthy relationship? What does enthusiastic consent look like? And it's not just pushing someone off of you physically and verbally saying no. It's much more complex than that.
There's much more of a structure in which consent can take place in the first place.
Yes. And I also want to encourage folks who are listening to take care of themselves. A lot of what we're talking about can be very triggering and difficult for them. And so check out your local supports in your area if you feel like you want to talk to somebody.
All right. And we'll get more into the You Have Options program that the Ashland Police obviously are running, and we have talked about on the program before. I'm curious to know, Steve, though, about when you talked about the officer investigating the case where the woman had sex because she thought she'd get beat up worse if she didn't.
Sure.
So she gave a yes. There was not a no. But the kinds of skills required of officers then investigating these cases, are they need to be a bit deeper than they used to be.
They do, and we need to ask more questions. And like Carrie was saying, we think we know what consent is. You know, no means no, but it doesn't have to necessarily be that verbal exchange. And so we tell the officers to look at what does no look like, and go deeper than, you know, I told him no, because we know this very well as officers of what no looks like. Because we document it in police reports. We tell somebody, you're under arrest, turn around and put your hands behind your back. And when they don't do that, we write a very detailed description of, you know, they crouched, they clenched their fists, their breathing became more rapid, those kinds of things. So we tell them to apply that to what a victim. When you told him no, how would he have known that you meant that? Well, I was crying, or I had my arms crossed against my chest. I was curled up in the fetal position. There's always more than just that verbal exchange. Just like in any relationship, when you get in bed with your partner and you are romantic and you put your arm around them, if they turn their back to you and pull the covers up under their chin, there hasn't been any verbal exchange, but they've clearly communicated to you that they're not interested in any romantic encounters that night. And so you have to learn that that's okay. And then, again, as Jenna referred to, the consent should be enthusiastic. None of us are looking for a partner that says, okay, you know, let me know when you're done, and they're just going to lay there. And so when you talk to some of these offenders and they say, you know, the victim, she was so into me, she wanted me. Well, what was she doing during this encounter? Well, she was crying the whole time, or she just lay there, she didn't move. That's not a sign of a consensual relationship. And so getting the officers to have more of a conversation and looking at what was going there and getting the picture more than she says, I said no, and he says no, she was into me and it was consensual. We've got to dig deeper and do more of an investigation.
You get a fair amount of surprised offenders, I'm thinking, who are like, what? No, she's always been like this and it's always been fine.
Yeah.
You know, telling the story that, you know, this is how our relationship is, when the story you get from the woman is completely different.
Completely different.
Wow. Okay, we'll take a short break here on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about sexual assault investigation and the state of the art in investigation and prosecution with Steve Belshaw, Deputy Chief at the Salem Police. Jenna Harper is the Training Program Coordinator at the Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. We'll take a short break on the Jefferson Exchange and come back and take your phone calls and emails. Feel free to join us at 800-838-3760 around the region and the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with our guests and you in a minute 25. It's 8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. You can take part in our program by calling 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or email us at jx@jeffnet.org. Check us out on Facebook as well. You'll see a picture of our guests. We're talking about sexual assault investigation and prosecution with Steve Belshaw, the Deputy Chief at Salem Police, and Jenna Harper, the Training Program Coordinator at the Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. We were just talking about the situations you get into where people are, they're pretty confident about their relationships with their partners, the ones they have sexually abused, thinking that, no, it's okay. We have done this before. So I'm just trying to figure out all the people you have to train, Jenna, as you go through the system. I mean, you're not just training prosecutors and nurses and first responders, but I mean, how many other people are you including in all the trainings you do?
Well, for us, we train the professionals. So we train advocates, we train the prosecutors, law enforcement. And it's something that we really do need to work on. So it's new information to them to talk about the dynamics in a relationship that don't necessarily just look like sexual assault, because within an intimate partner violence situation, sometimes it's not just physical violence. There's other things that happen, like forcing your partner to watch pornography, making sexual jokes about them. And there's all these different parts to it that almost normalizes the sexually violent parts of their relationship so that they don't realize what they're experiencing is something that would be considered a crime. And so there's dynamics that we need to talk to all folks about, advocates, prosecutors, law enforcement, and then have our advocates also talking to their community and the survivors who are coming in for domestic violence about what was going on in their relationship.
There must be some tricky lines here then for both police and prosecutors, though, because you'll get people who've been in relationships for a long time and say, I was always okay with this, but then I realized it wasn't a good thing. I talked to some friends and realized, no, this isn't good. So it's not just an issue of consent, but there are some legal lines in there to consider too as well, Steve, aren't there?
Sure. And that's part of has been a part of our learning curve, because in law enforcement, we didn't realize the importance of the history. So a husband and wife have a fight tonight, and the officer gets here and says, okay, tell me what happened. And the wife will say, well, this started 6 months ago. And the officer say, no, I don't care about what happened 6 months ago. Tell me what happened tonight. Well, what we've learned is we need to know what happened 6 months ago. We need to know what's led up to this and how they've gotten to this point. Because as you've noted, our advocates and shelters, as they're talking to these victims, It's usually anywhere from the 7th to the 15th assault before the victim first calls the police and realizes there's a problem. So when we get there and the offender says, this is the first time I've lost my temper, the studies will show that's not true. It's been multiple times before, but the victim this is somebody she loves. She's invested a lot of time into. She's hoping she can fix this relationship if I just do this differently or something like that. But the problem is that it'll never be enough because it's about control. And so we have to learn about that history and what's going on in that relationship.
We had mentioned, I think, that 80% of all sexual assaults are by people known to the victim. Is that right, Jenna?
Somewhere I would say that or higher even, maybe.
That or higher, mm-hmm. Okay. Now, do we have a breakdown within that 80%, though? But how many of these are in committed long-term relationships, anything like that?
I don't think any of the studies have looked at it that in-depth, but you know, that most of the vast majority of the sexual assaults are committed by somebody that is known to them, and that's part of the problem. Is a lot of our studies are based, the cases that are most likely to be reported are the stranger sexual assaults or the very violent sexual assaults, and those are the fewest that happen. And so we're interviewing the ones that are not smart enough to get away with it, and B, the ones that are in the minority. And so what we're learning, and there's some very good studies. Dr. David Lezak from the University of Boston has done some studies with what he calls the undetected rapists, so some blind studies with offenders that have never been interviewed by law enforcement to find out what they're doing. And his studies show that on average these offenders are that he's interviewing, and they're young men 18 to 25 years old, on average have committed 11 felony crimes apiece and have never been contacted by the police. So they're using their ability to talk and to control people to get away with these crimes, and they're hurting our communities.
Is there a pattern that gets set by a certain age? I mean, if somebody has been doing this a bit by the time they're, I don't know, 22, 25, somewhere in there, is it likely to continue?
It's likely to continue until we do something to stop them. And what you have to do is make the consequences more egregious than continuing to engage in that behavior. So you have to be able to correct that behavior and hold them accountable.
In some ways, have investigators, prosecutors had to really throw out the old book and start anew? I mean, not only just training new procedures, but having to untrain old ones as well?
Yeah. It's we're having to learn a lot of new things. I was telling the class yesterday, when I started 25 years ago, when my coach told me when we went to domestic, husband and wife fighting, you initially said, I don't care what happened. You guys figure it out. But if I come back here tonight, both of you are going to jail. And that's how we solve the problem. Well, we know we didn't solve the problem. It just went underground. And so we are having to relearn a lot of the things that we have done in the past.
All right, which brings us then to the cusp of the discussion about the You Have Options program that has been made famous by the Ashland Police Department, which really gives women a chance to take their time and think about things. Can one of you describe some of the basic tenets of the program as you understand it?
Sure. What it does is give the victim control back of their case. It's their case. It's not my case. And that's kind of been the flavor of law enforcement. We're the professionals. Stand back. Let us take charge, and we'll make everything better. Well, we're not making everything better. So we've got to let the victim take charge of their case. So the You Have Options program lets them make an anonymous report. I want you to know what happened. I want you to know the name of this potential offender in our community and tell you what's going on and want it documented. We know we're not going to be able to prosecute it. We're not going to be able to go interview this offender. All we're going to be able to do is document that. They can make a partial report where they give us their name. We collect evidence, but we're not going to go interview the suspect yet, or we're not going to do that. We're going to give them time until they are ready to move forward with that, but we give them control. Or they can make a full typical police report. But even in that full police report, we're not going to make an arrest or we're not going to move forward with prosecution until the victim says they're ready to do that. And if at any point the victim says, I'm not ready for that yet, we're going to stop that investigation until such time as they're ready to go. That's completely foreign to how we've done investigations in the past. It's been our investigation, law enforcement's investigation, and we're in control of it. And once you tell us what the crime is, then you have no say in that anymore. So this is completely different in how we're investigating these cases.
Which here again requires some new skills of police officers, not just in the questioning part, but also in the holding back part, not thinking about we need to clear this case, get it off the board, et cetera.
Yeah. I don't know if you've been around very many police officers, but they're
a few over years.
Typically what they call a type A personality, and they're used to coming into a situation and taking charge. And so this is causing some concern for some of our officers of, this is my investigation and this is how I've always done it, and trying to get them to pull back a little bit and understand the value of this program. Because, very few agencies will take anonymous police reports where a victim can call in and say, hey, I was sexually assaulted by Joe Smith. I just want you to know about that. And law enforcement typically has said, if you're not going to come forward and give me your name, we're not going to document this. Why would I not want to know the name of somebody in my community that's committing crimes? Maybe I can't do anything about it, but maybe I can. Maybe I have four other reports involving Joe Smith, and it lets me know I'm on the right track. Or when that second report comes in, then I know there's some credibility to that victim because I already have a report on that person and those kinds of things. So gathering that information. Before, only 20% of these cases are being reported, so we had zero information. Now I've got more information, and as you've talked to Carrie at the Ashland Police Department, in the couple of years they've been doing locally the You Have Options program, their reporting rate has gone up 106%. That's phenomenal. That is a bigger increase than any department I've ever seen across the nation. And so they're building the trust in the community. They're building the trust in the victims. That is a phenomenal increase, and it's giving them information about what is going on in the community that most communities don't have.
We're talking about sexual assault investigation and prosecution with Steve Belshaw from the Salem Police and Jenna Harper from the Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force here in the Jefferson Exchange, with a particular focus on the Ashland Police Department's You Have Options program. There was something like this already at Salem Police, and you shared some of your notes with Ashland Police. Is that right?
Salem Police Department about 20 years ago decided we would take anonymous police reports and third-party police reports. So a roommate comes home and said she was sexually assaulted by that, and her roommate feels the police ought to know about what happened, but the victim's not ready to come forward and talk to us, we would take that report. Carrie Hull and the Ashland Police Department with Chief Holderness were looking about how to improve reporting rates, and so they were looking for agencies that did something similar. So Carrie contacted me, and I explained to her what we were doing. But she had this vision of taking it further and doing this online reporting and opening it up to a much broader base than we ever conceived of doing. And she ran with it. And now this training today is taking the program nationwide. And we have agents. I think we have 32 agencies from eight different states across the country that are here that want to replicate this program. And so, Ashland's leading the way in this program, and you'll start seeing this. And I truly believe in the next 5 years, communities are going to demand programs like this, that this is going to be their expectation, that victims have the opportunity to do this type of reporting.
Jenna Harper, does it feel like you've reached the point where not only is there a lot of excitement about programs like You Have Options, but you've turned a corner, gotten to a different level of understanding about the ways to proceed in sexual assault cases?
I think that there's still a lot of work to do. I love this program because I think it's so successful because they're working with advocacy and they're working with advocate concepts. So letting people who come in who say have experienced this identify their primary concerns. So, you know, talking to someone off the street, they might think that, you know, someone who's just experienced a sexual assault, they would be hysterical, they would be emotional, they just want medical help, they want this person taken away. But oftentimes that's not someone's primary concern. It could be having to do with making sure they get to work the next day and getting out of the hospital, getting out of the police department, wherever they were. And so what they really do well here in Ashland is they work, they always have an advocate in with them, and they work with their advocates to say, what is it that's going on with you right now, and where are you at in this? And I think that identifying primary needs, and also what is it that's going to stop you from coming back and talking to us? What are your concerns? Are you afraid of this? Are you concerned about people finding out? Because we know that confidentiality is one of the top issues that people are concerned about if they come forward.
And so when you talk about the advocates, these people like the nurse advocates, sexual assault nurse advocates?
So the sexual assault nurse examiners are not advocates, but they're the folks who would medically treat survivors and do the rape kit. There are a group of folks, and there's one for every community that serves every community, and they are just there. They're confidential sources that victims can go to. They can talk to them. They can hook them up with counseling. They can help them out with housing issues. They can just talk to them on hotlines if they just want someone to talk about. And they give them their options. So they talk to them about what they can do, whether it's engaging in the criminal justice system or just talking to somebody.
It's really just about making sure that the needs of the victim or the survivor are addressed first. Then you can think about maybe going ahead and investigating this as a criminal case.
Absolutely.
And so, but this presents some interesting issues, obviously, for any police department. When you talk about, hey, this is great, Ashland showed a 130% increase, which, mm-hmm. you know, if somebody stacks up the statistics a certain way, it's going to look like 130% increase in sexual assault crimes.
Sure. And if you're going to engage in this program, you're going to have to lay the groundwork for your city council and those folks to say, look, we're going to roll out this program. You're going to see a change in numbers. Here's why the numbers are going to increase. And it's a good thing. We want those numbers to increase. We want to encourage people to come forward and tell us what's going on in the community.
Where do you see things going in the years to come? I mean, the different wrinkles to the You Have Options program that might have developed in the couple of years that Ashland's had it that are making people think, hey, let's try this now.
Well, the changes that are coming, I think you'll see other online options for reporting and things like that. But it's hard to tell where the trend is going. How we're interviewing victims with the trauma stuff is becoming much more critical. DNA science is changing every year and how we're using that. So we expect that will continue to change and our ability to use that. And then hopefully the treatment of offenders and keeping them from engaging in that. And then again, we need to address this problem earlier. A lot of times when we go to communities and we say, here's the problem of sexual assault, and how do we address that? The answers we hear are, let's teach women self-defense classes, or let's teach the buddy system. And my answer is usually, how about if we teach men to stop raping or stop hitting women? Why should we have to teach women how to protect themselves? Let's teach the men to stop doing those kinds of things.
Jenna, you're nodding. It sounds like we could use some more frank discussions about sex at an earlier age.
Yes. When we talk about prevention, I think most people think about the rape whistle, right? Self-defense classes. And when we talk about primary prevention, what we mean, there's certain norms in our society that maintain this high level of gendered violence, right? So what we're talking about now in terms of primary prevention is talking about, what does a healthy relationship look like? And what does healthy sexuality look like? Sometimes we don't even talk about sex. So then how can we know what consent is? And how can we know what healthy sex versus unhealthy sex looks like? So talking about that and talking about that at an earlier age, engaging in that type of conversation, I think, is going to be really important. We need to do this focus on response, but we also need to focus on prevention.
All right. I want to thank you both for spending the time talking to us about sexual assault and how we investigate it in society. We're out of time. Steve Belshaw is deputy chief at the Salem Police. Jenna Harper is training program coordinator at the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force. Thank you both very much.